I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCBX studios. Come along and join us for a conversation with Hillary and Molly from Booker Vineyard.
I'm Hillary Graves.
And I'm Molly Lomborg.
And what do you guys do there?
I manage the farming at Booker.
So see you on the tractor?
I have not driven a tractor in many years, but I did used to.
Okay, so you know how to fire it up.
Yes.
So you're all about regenerative agriculture.
It's a basic part of our philosophy at Booker Vineyard. Mm-hmm. We believe in having the softest touch that we can in our farming practices. And so we are CCOF certified organic and regenerative organic certified.
That's really cool. Dig a little deeper on regenerative because it's the cutting edge in ag across the board today.
Yeah, I think it's a throwback, actually. I think that a long time ago, people naturally farmed that way. And then as agriculture skewed more to productivity, people have moved away from it. Mm-hmm. But we are starting to learn now that soil health is everything. And it's the basic building block for all of our farm success. Mm-hmm. So regenerative agriculture contributes to soil health and really focuses on that. And so that's where we're
interesting.
That's where we're heading.
Well, I'm familiar with regenerative from cattle range management. A friend of mine does that. The difference is you can't rotate your crop. You're stuck with the same planting.
That's right.
So talk to us about how you maximize.
Yes. So you're right. I'm not growing a crop that I can switch out every year. So when we plant a vineyard, we really would like to get at least 20 to 25 years out of a vineyard asset, mm-hmm. and longer if we can. What I do instead to contribute to our regenerative practices, because I can't switch out my cash crop, I do switch out my cover crop. So I spend as much time and effort and attention.
Is that partly nitrogen fixing?
Yes. Oh. So we're trying to increase biodiversity, increase nitrogen in the soil, feed our grapevines. It also serves a lot of other purposes as well. Provides habitat for beneficial insects and mm-hmm. even insects that are not beneficial. But in my case, having the cover crop as a place for them to live is mm-hmm. very important, because then they'll stay in the cover crop instead of move to my grapevines. And then a really big one also is, you know, water in the West is a precious mm-hmm. Resource and limited resource. And so our cover crop lets us be able to capture rainwater and hold it in the soil.
So you do some dry farming then?
We do not dry farm. Okay. So I do apply irrigation. Mm-hmm. We're applying, it's all measured. We have meters on our wells and we keep really close records of how much water we're applying. So right now, most years we're applying about 0.2 acre feet per acre. Mm-hmm. And just to put that into perspective, most irrigated vineyards in the Paso Robles area are applying about an acre foot of water per acre.
Big difference.
Then we're doing 0.2 acre feet per acre.
So the cover crop, I presume, helps to mitigate evaporation. True,
right. Or? So it essentially makes the earth a bigger sponge. So mm-hmm. when you are able, you know, you cover every square inch of land that has been trusted to me with a green growing plant, mm-hmm. and it creates a bigger sponge. So when the rain falls on the earth, we can catch it and hold it instead of having it run off and cause erosion, things mm-hmm. like that.
Interesting. But you are on a sloping location.
Very steep slopes.
So you do have some runoff.
We don't, actually.
You're able to mitigate that by your practices.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
It's something that's really important to us. I don't remember what year that was, Molly, when we got like 40 inches of rain. And the 22
23,
winter?
Yeah.
22,
mm-hmm.
23. Mm-hmm. And I had actually used a tool called a yeoman's plow in every row of the vineyard. And I was very concerned about runoff.
Yeah.
I was driving out like four times, just doing laps, looking four times a day, looking, just waiting for erosion. And I think just a combination of our cover crop mm-hmm. and the attention to detail that we had put into our farming practices, we didn't have any erosion, even in a really, really heavy rain year.
Interesting. Well, they talk about royal dirt being poor man's soil, rocky. So that implies well-drained, right?
It does. And we do have rocky soils. You're right. I call them frugal. But grapevines are weeds, and they do really well in the Paso Robles environment.
It's such a paradox. I hear wine growers, grape growers talking about kind of stressing the plants. Naively, you think, oh, give them more water, you know, but not so.
Yeah, we know because science tells us that we can manipulate quality from the period of when we have pea-sized berries in the vineyard to veraison. So we are imparting moderate water stress during that time. So my goal, really all I am, I'm just a person who grows leaves. I just need to grow the right number of leaves and keep them healthy. That's my whole job. And so I try to have all the leaves that I need to ripen my crop by the time I have pea-sized berries. And then impart moderate stress, and at veraison, when the grapes start to accumulate sugar and color, we're doing just dosed water after that to maintain the health of the canopy that we have.
How do you monitor that? By walking the rows and doing actual testing of?
Yes. Yeah. So part of it comes definitely with experience. And when you become familiar with the place that you're farming, you can anticipate how the vines are going to behave. I like to look at vines, obviously. My preference is around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That is when, if it's a hot, you know, they're most stressed at that time. So I should see a lot of leaf backs at that time of the day. So as a defense mechanism, the grapevines turn their backs to the sun to try to hold on to the water that they have. They close their stomata. They're just like hunkering down. And then I look at them again the next morning, and they should have recovered overnight. If they have not, then I look at, we have soil moisture probes across our vineyard, so I can see how much water is available to them. And different varietals behave differently. So sometimes they still look rough in the morning. I look at the soil moisture probes and I can see that they have water. And I just am like, okay, girls, you need to, we're going to get through this here. But I see that our soil moisture probes, that there's not a lot of water available, we will irrigate.
Interesting. And then being on the west side, you have the moderating effects of the maritime. Talk to us about that.
Yes, we do. So it's very normal for us to have 40 degree temperature swings from day to night. Yes, we have the Templeton Gap, which, you know, brings all of that cool air. I call it, it's kind of an air conditioner. I mean, almost every day at like 2 o'clock, probably, you'll get the wind starts to pick up and it cools things down.
But 10 miles away, the east side of Paso, you wouldn't have that, right?
It's really shocking how far
it goes.
Yeah, like, I mean,
I know it goes out El Pomar that way.
Yeah, and I live in Creston.
Okay,
and
so all the way out there.
Yeah, it cool. We have cool nights as well.
Wow.
So yeah, Paso is kind of it's a great place for wine grapes.
That's really interesting.
I think the wines show that.
So for a moment, what varietals do you grow?
For Booker, our estate's 160 acres. We have about 85 acres planted, and about half of that is Syrah. So we're a Rhone house, Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèd. We do have a few odds and ends, but they're not a focal point of our production.
Have you had any surprises that you weren't sure if it would even work?
From a standpoint of varieties?
Yeah.
We have some Tannat at the estate it's just really interesting to me because it looks so different from a lot of varietals.
Well, and it's funny, I was back in Virginia with winemakers and they're growing it there and bragging about it. Really cool.
And we also have some Tempranillo, which is, you know, really random. We make just a small amount. It's available to our wine club or in our tasting room, but it's a fan favorite. And I think it was a little bit of a wild card when Eric first planted it. And now we have people that just are obsessed with the Tempranillo.
I call the Tempranillo, it's like the class clown. So our Syrah vines, they're so committed to their job and they take their work so seriously. When you farm a place for a while, you get to know the personalities. Yeah. I know people think it's crazy, but I really do believe that a place shows itself to you. But the Tempranillo, oh my gosh, it's like, so Syrah, super dedicated, Tempranillo never comes to class, doesn't do the homework, always gets an A.
That's funny. I love it. So you have a fondness then?
I think all good farmers become very, very emotionally attached to the land that they take care of.
Mm-hmm. Lucky for you, Tom, we brought you a bottle of our
That's
Tempranillo.
That's so awesome. We'll have to share that with a couple people here. Love it. So, pull the lens back a little bit. You're on 46 West?
We are, yeah. We're located on Anderson Road, just at the very end of Anderson Road.
So not too far from 101, but not too far from Cambridge.
Yeah, it's amazing because it's such an easy stop, you know, if you're looking for somewhere to taste.
Yeah.
And we actually have tasting rooms for both of our brands on property. So we have Booker, where you can experience our estate-grown Rhones, which, as Hillary mentioned, our vineyard is CCOF and ROC certified.
Talk to us about CCOF for a moment, because that's pretty big time on the Central Coast.
It is. I mean, they're our gold standard for organic certification. It's really great because they're the ones also that have embraced the regenerative organic certification. So to become ROC certified, you have to be CCOF certified. And it's amazing. You know, I think many of us that think about what we put into our body, you know, we're turning and we're looking at labels. And when you see that seal, you just kind of feel comfortable.
Yeah.
For me, I'm the person that reads through all the ingredients. But once I see that seal, I know I don't have to keep reading. And so it's kind of interesting. We've had these practices in the vineyard since 2021 certified, but years before that. But this past year, we finally decided to also certify the winery. So moving forward, our 2025 vintage and beyond for Booker will all be CCOF certified and ROC certified.
Oh, cool.
So they'll all say made with organic grapes.
Is your case production designed to be able to be consumed by the wine club?
Pretty much. We're a bit of a scarcity model at Booker. We have a really dedicated and amazing club, and they're really our family. But we do make enough to be able to sustain the tasting room. So,
and how about retail? Is it available?
Retail is very small presence for Booker. So we have another brand called My Favorite Neighbor, which we also have a tasting room at our site for. And that is really fun because that's Cabernet and Chardonnay, not necessarily from our property, but that's sourced from local vineyards. We
all
also
of our favorite neighbors.
Yep, exactly. And Hillary can tell you the whole story because it's a pretty great story of the name of the wine. But it's fun if you do ever come out to see us. We also do vineyard designation. Where Hillary's handpicked some of the best West Side vineyards.
Nice.
And we make Cabernet the same way from 3 to 6 different vineyards a year. Made the same way, put in the same type of barrels, bottled at the same time. And you really just get to taste the difference of what the West Side has to offer.
Yeah. But even in a micro sense, it blows my mind that 500 yards away, you can have different characteristics, correct?
Oh, I mean, a hillside away. Like, it's so interesting because I worked at a couple different vineyards making wine. They were literally 10 minutes apart on Adelaida Road. And I would make the wine, which was the same rootstock and the same clone grown relatively close in the same AVA and completely different expressions of what that grape gave you in the bottle. So, I mean, even on our own property, that those same characteristics grown on a hillside versus, you know, lower down, we don't really have true valley floor sites. Most of our whole site is very hilly. But from the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill can give you a different expression.
Wow. Do you ever do any marriage and
Lots of it. We kind of start our blending process in the vineyard a lot of the times.
So you know then where you want to go.
I mean, we do our best. None of us have the crystal ball, but we try. But sometimes it just gets to the point where, you know, Hillary and I are walking a vineyard, block and we say, you know, we only want to harvest the lower part of the vines. Okay, well, that's going to give you 1 ton of fruit. Well, our smallest tank might need 3 tons of fruit. So then we go and taste what else? Like, we think this is going to go into Vertigo, which is our Syrah Grenache Mourvèd blend. So what else is of similar quality? Kind of like putting the puzzle together and finding what other parts will go together. So we start our blending process in the vineyard and then in the tank. And then, of course, it continues on for the following year to
really
18 months. Yeah.
So are you walking the fields with her sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, Molly's particularly good at this process that she just explained. Mm-hmm. So when we're gearing up to start picking grapes, she is walking miles up and down rows. And generally, we're tasting fruit and deciding where she wants to do the cutoff. You know, okay, I want to pick this block, part of this block. And then the process that she just described to you is, I think, something that she's very, very good at, which is like, it's a little bit of a definitely, like she said, crystal ball, trying to look forward into what's going to be a good match.
Interesting. Yeah. I know you see Davis frowns on it, but native yeast fermentation, do you ever do that?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I love native fermentations. Mm-hmm. It's not everything we do. I've worked at wineries where that's all we did, but we are starting to incorporate it more in. So now that we got this organic certification, we are working to just like reevaluate everything we do and see, is there even a more natural way to do that? And so native yeast is kind of a shoo-in in that category. We played around with a few tanks this year, and I think it'll be something we just kind of continue to work with.
On the other side of the spectrum, though, I know some people in the industry that they like a specific yeast to give them characteristics. So are you tempted to do that?
We do use yeast. And so we do have kind of what would be our house yeast strain that we like. And then personally, just through my years, like, I love yeast selection when you're looking at whites and rosés, because I feel like the impact of how they can release the thiols and the esters can change so much. You know, I've made a rosé side by side out of Grenache. Everything was the same. I used two different types of yeast. One showed wild strawberry and watermelon, and the other showed ripe, juicy peaches.
Wow.
And it's like so cool to kind of see how they can drive that. With reds, a lot of times there's so much other things going on. Like, the phenolic content is so big that the yeast trials are a lot more difficult. Like, I have done them and tracked the phenolic content of different yeasts, and you try to go sensory, but there's just so many things that come into play that it's a bit harder. Yeah. So I think a lot of people, when they're deciding yeast, they kind of go to kinetics and what works well for their timelines and overall temperatures and processes.
Is there an average barrel aging time, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the wine, the style of the wine. Yeah. At Booker, we have a kind of an interesting program. I don't know many other people that do this. So we have 5 core reds. I mentioned Tempranillo as one of our kind of wine club wines. We also have Ripper, which is 100% Grenache, another small production wine club wine. And then we have 3 core wines. So we have Oublier, which is our GSM. We have Vertigo, which is our SGM. And then our flagship wine is Fracture, which is just your classic big Syrah. Now, for all 5 of these wines, we make our blends, then we barrel age them. We bottle a portion after 18 months, and then we go back to barrel in the same percentage of...
You lost me.
Okay, so we pull it up. Okay, so right now, we just pulled all of our 2024s into tank.
Yeah.
So we had our entire blend. We pull it all up into tank, and then we take a portion, and we go back down to barrel with the same percentage of new oak, basically the same types of new oak it was in. And we hold on to that portion and bottle it again after 22 months.
Wow.
So all of our wines have what we call the 18-month version and then the extended version, or a 22-month version.
And there's a marked difference?
Actually can be. And it's so interesting. So it's really fun. We have some of our tasting experiences at Booker. We have some elevated experiences, like a cave tasting or up in our terrace. And there you'll dive deeper into our program. program, and you can taste the 18-month version of the wine against the extended. It's a 22-month aging. Yeah.
Well, and again, you take it one step further. I know there's that temptation element, but then bottle aging.
I know.
That's really fascinating.
Yes.
So talk about that further dimension.
Yeah. I mean, I love bottle aging wines. I think it's a fine balance personally, mm-hmm. because I will tell you, we were talking a little bit about COVID earlier, right? So my husband and I are both in the industry. COVID hit. We had one baby. We live out on a ranch. We were like, well, we don't know if the world's going to end. So we might as well start drinking this wine cellar. Right. You know, so every night was like our thing, like put on the record, make the dinner, like no holds bar on the wine mm-hmm. fridge. And I've always been like, you can't touch anything in the back row, Jordy. And so we were like, we're just doing it. Mm-hmm. And it was really sad because even at that point, I had bottles that had already gone bad, you know, that wow. I had been holding on to. Mm-hmm. And that was almost heartbreaking yeah. for me. And so I love bottle aging wines, but I also never want to see a wine go bad because we held on to it for too long, you know? So as winemakers, we do have to be a little careful about how we make our wines. Mm-hmm. Again, we're not in Italy, right? We're not making wines that people know the tannins are so intense, they're going to lay them down for, you know, years before they're opened. Yeah. Like, so we have to make a wine that is approachable within weeks of bottling, mm-hmm. but then also can withstand some aging. And I think Paso Robles, we're a hot climate, yeah. right? So everybody knows we have some big wines that mm-hmm. tends to come with some alcohol, can come with some tannins too, though.
Yeah.
So I personally love Paso wines in the 5 to 7 year range. Mm-hmm. If I got a bottle that's freshly bottled, I love to hold on to it for around 6 to 8 months if mm-hmm. I can, yeah. In the red category.
Sure. Even in that short of time, you'll
it'll start to develop. Yeah. yeah. It'll really start cool. to develop. And well, I think it's
the other end of the spectrum. I remember being in some barrel tastings with the thief and going, oh my God, if you bottled this right now, I'd yep. love it. That's mm-hmm. how cool Paso wines are.
Yeah. I know, it is kind of funny because sometimes we get it in our mind like we have these processes, right? Like we're going to bottle our wines after 18 months and then again mm-hmm. after 22 months. And in our recent history, we had in 2022, as you know, we had one of the hottest vintages on record. We had that heat dome, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, oh, this is so not, this is beyond a heat wave. We're going to make a new term for this. It was that intense.
Yeah.
And those wines are beautiful wines, but in tasting through barrel, you realize that those wines were ready to go to bottle a little sooner. Mm-hmm. They weren't like the 21s that were so structured and could have held on more months in barrel. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of us pulled up our bottlings by a few months and said, you know what, we're going to bottle these a few months earlier and try to maintain some of that freshness mm-hmm. and that liveliness of the wines mm-hmm. and kind of get them under cork and keep them fresh now. So I think being like nimble and being able to kind of move with what the vintage gives you is mm-hmm. really important for ensuring that the wine will hold on.
Back to the mystery of aging wine. I spent time in Scotland out in the Hebrides.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they would have these just ancient places to age their barrels. And the Angel Share
yep.
was the salt air, and you could taste that salty tang in the whiskey. So bringing it back home,
that's cool.
Talk to us about the Angel Share. I know it's a yep. kind of mysterious and hard to quantify, but it does.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
It does. So in winemaking, I would say New World winemaking, mm-hmm. Typically, I would say every 4 to 8 weeks, depending on your style, we go in and we kind of top up the mm-hmm. Angel Share. So each month, you know, we're going to lose some wine. So
and
it is,
for the listener, just in case, yeah. that is basically evaporation.
It is.
That's what the angel is stealing. Right?
Yep. yeah. But it's crazy because, you know, you can sit there. I've topped the barrel myself. I put the bung in. Yep. I don't touch it. I'm not sampling out of it. I'm not doing anything. I open it up 4 weeks later and all of a sudden there's An inch down is my wine. I'm like, wait, where did it go? Mm-hmm. So that's what we call the angel share. So we go in once a month and we top it up. Mm-hmm. So ideally, we're using the same wine to top itself. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting. I remember early in my career, I was like, well, how much is this? Like, what does this equate to? And I remember like calculating it all out, because a lot of times it could be between, like on a monthly basis, it was between around 800 mils to a liter that you're adding. And then if you think about 18 months, say it's a liter a month for 18 months, that's 18 liters. That's two cases of wine out of a 24 case barrel. So like, it is substantial. It's pretty interesting. So you really want to be careful. I think a lot of people, and this might be getting like too far into the winemaking side, so sorry, you can cut me off anytime. But a lot of people will make their blends and then they kind of are like, oh, well, this wine's like my worst wine. I'm just going to use that for topping. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, you should be topping with your best wine because that is going to end up being somewhere between 5 and 8% of your wine. Mm-hmm. And so I get it. Like, we never want to lose what is our best. We want to know that's going into bottle. But honestly, you have to be topping with good stuff.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, the angels don't like it if you top with bad stuff.
Yeah, really. They get upset. So back in time in your life, how did this all start for you? Did you grow up in a winemaker family?
No, I did not. I grew up in Mendocino.
Okay.
So much more greener agriculture up there. I did drive through Anderson Valley often. So to get anywhere, it's a very remote town on the northern coast of California. So to get anywhere, it was an hour and a half on windy roads that drove through Anderson Valley. And I always saw the grapevines, but nothing. Like, no wine family. I think Two Buck Chuck came out when I was in high school and my parents started buying it. And I finally had something where they said, if you're here at the house, you can touch this. And I was like, yes. But no wine exposure. I came to the area to go to Cal Poly.
In what major?
Earth and soil science.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did a year and a quarter, and then I went to study geology in New Zealand for a year.
Wow.
I was playing rugby at the time, so I wanted to go play there. And then when I came back, I realized there was this whole wine and vit department. It wasn't actually a major when I had first come in.
Yep.
And I was like, well, this is so cool. Like, I didn't even work a harvest in New Zealand. I did nothing with wine in New Zealand. But I came back, was like, this is amazing. I think I could get into this.
Mm-hmm.
But I was pretty far in my studies at that point, and I loved what I was doing. So I didn't want to give that up, but I was able to create a minor. I was able to do it as like a concentration under my major by picking up the minor.
Mm-hmm.
So I got really lucky. And honestly, I thought I was going to work in the vineyard. That was my whole plan, was to do sustainable and organic viticulture work.
Well, being a dirt major.
Yeah. And I'm from Mendocino, which like we're all about organic, you know, first county to outlaw GMO product. But I also, at the time, the program wasn't super strong. Like, I didn't leave with a great foundation of how to make wine. And I knew if I ever wanted to become a good grape grower that I needed to fully understand the winemaking process. So I went to work a couple internships thinking I would do that and then leave.
So you were a cellar rat?
Yeah. So I started in the lab for Baileyana, Orchid Road Cellars. And then I went and worked in the cellar for Justin. And then my whole plan was to leave and go in the vineyard. But then I got offered a full-time job, and I just got kind of sucked in. So
interesting.
Yeah.
But you work great with her then.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's so exciting for me. I've been super lucky because I've always been able to work at a state vineyard. Mm-hmm. So I can always like walk out my door and be in the vineyard. But in my 17 years of doing this, I've never got to work with another woman. True. That has been so much fun. So yeah, we have way too much fun together.
True. And back in your life, how did it all start for you?
My path to being a farmer is very a crooked road. So I do come from a farming family. My family farms in Firebaugh, which is
in the
Central Valley.
Yeah.
Yes. None of them grow wine grapes. They primarily, I mean, now water's difficult there, but a lot of cotton, a lot of melons, lima beans. I remember my grandpa growing sugar beets at one point. And I never thought that I would go into farming. My dad left the family farming business when I was in second grade. Mm-hmm. He had enlisted during Vietnam and then got out for a while and then decided to go back into the military. So I spent my life moving around a lot. And I spent most of my growing up years in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Which was a great experience. And now,
on what island?
On Oahu.
Oahu, yeah.
Now I have this super unique job, right? Because I am a farmer who works in the luxury hospitality business. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for me to see how Hawaii is just a place of hospitality. The people just are so warm and welcoming. And that applies to my work now, which I'm really grateful for. So back to how this happened. I got a business degree, and then I went—
At UH?
I got my degree at Fresno State. When it was time for me to go to college, my dad didn't know where his next duty station was going to be. And so I went to Fresno State because my grandparents were close by. I got a business degree there, and then I went to grad school in Texas at Texas Women's University in Denton. Wow. And I got a master's degree in library and information science.
You would have guessed that, right?
I was an academic librarian. Wow. And I was working at Fresno State I was the librarian at the Viticulture and Enology Research Center, which is where they do current scientific research on grape growing and winemaking. Mm-hmm. And I needed a second master's to get tenure. So I started taking classes in crop science. And then my husband and I moved here to Santa Margarita. I was working at Cal Poly, and I started doing my course of study there. I started teaching for my professor that I was working for, at teaching viticulture classes. And then I just decided, you know, I like this better. So I started farming.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And where did you start farming?
Well, my husband and I bought a property and planted a vineyard. We bought that property in 1999.
Whereabouts?
It was in Creston.
Okay.
And so we put in a vineyard, and I started a wine brand. I was farming that vineyard, and then I kind of expanded, started a vineyard management company. I was farming some vineyards in the west side of Paso Robles. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met Eric Jensen, because I was farming some vineyards where he was buying fruit for my favorite neighbor. So he and I had worked together for a long time.
So he asked you to come to work for him then?
Actually, I asked him. So how that happened is my daughters, who are now 22 and 23, when they started, you know, growing their wings and kind of going out, being gone a lot, I was really lonely. Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to join a team, work with a team of people. So I thought, you know, who do I know that has the same kind of farming philosophy that I do? And that was where, you know, when I'm talking about that, I mean with organic and regenerative practices. And I thought of Eric Jensen. So I just reached out and said, hey, I'm kind of looking to join a team of people that think like I do. Let me know if you have any need. Mm-hmm. And 10 minutes later, he called me and he was like, let's go.
How meant to be, huh?
Yeah, I joined his team in 2020, and I've been there since then.
So I understand that ownership has changed, but is he still involved there?
Yes.
On a daily basis?
Yeah, so the history of Booker and how that whole thing unfolded. So Eric and Lisa Jensen are the founders of Booker Vineyard. They bought that property in 2001, planted the vineyard in 2002, and then their first vintage was in 2005. The wines were highly anticipated, and they experienced a lot of success early on. Eric decided that he wanted to dabble in Cabernet, and so he started the My Favorite Neighbor brand. And then he realized, you know, he wanted to make wines that were accessible to a wider group of people. He was thinking about his parents, Harvey mm-hmm. and Harriet, who were working class people.
Yeah.
So he started Harvey and Harriet to satisfy that. Mm-hmm. And we knew, as Eric grew Harvey and Harriet and My Favorite Neighbor, that we would need a corporate partner to sell that much wine.
Yeah.
So we were in 2021. We were acquired by Constellation Brands, and they have been that corporate partner for us.
But they're not meddling. They let you guys do.
Yes. Yep. No one at Constellation has ever told us how to farm or make wine. Eric and Lisa are still involved in the brand. Our team is still intact. There are a lot of changes that happen when you move from like an entrepreneurial mindset to a corporate one. Mm-hmm. I think the strength of our team, the loyalty that we have for each other, the longevity of, you know, our relationships has helped us be able to maintain the integrity of our wines and our brands And we're really proud of that.
You guys know you're spoiled, right?
Yeah. Yes. Every day we walk outside and look around, I pinch myself.
I do too. I go in the vineyard and I'm like, wow, I cannot believe people trust me to take care of this place.
And getting paid too.
Yeah.
I love it. To learn more about your world, one thing we really haven't talked about, that's the mothership and going for a visit.
Yes.
The wine caves and tasting and whatnot. Talk to us about that for a moment.
Yeah, we have a really beautiful hospitality center. Our team does such a great job. We would love to have visitors. We're located at 2644 Anderson Road.
And off of 46 West.
That's right. Yeah. Off of 46 West in Paso Robles. We do have a really beautiful cave. We have bocce ball, tasting terrace, and it's a really spectacular location.
And you have some dinners, special stuff, right?
We do have dinners. I should have written them down. I just reposted them on our Instagram today. But we do have lots of dinners at where we welcome people to come and join us and have an experience, a taste of Booker hospitality.
And so one stop would be your website to start out?
I think that's a good place to start, in our Instagram.
Yeah, definitely head to the website from there. We have websites for all three brands, Booker, My Favorite Neighbor, and Harvey and Harriet.
And the website is
BookerWines.com.
Yep. And MyFavoriteNeighbor.com too.
Too easy. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We're always happy to share our story. And
well, it's a wonderful story. It really is, from the heart.
My name is Hillary Graves, and I manage the farming at Booker Vineyard.
My name is Molly Lomborg, and I'm the winemaker for Booker and My Favorite Neighbor.
I love it. Thank you guys so much. Now I have to come out and go in the cave.
You have to.
I would love it. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from KCBX Studios in San Luis Obispo. We'll see you out in the field.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station. Yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving place. Buy all of your guns and pumps and explode into space. I like smoking lightning, heavy metal thunder, racing with the wind, and the feeling that I'm under. Yeah, darling, go make it happen. And what?